jump up, sing gigs,
and then in the north of Ireland, in Armagh, run Christmas and New Year there.
Well, we're doing a little test here on seeing how things shape up on the amplifier here. At least our signal looks good, I think. You're listening to Enlightened Radio, broadcasting from the Red Caboose in Bolivar, West Virginia, here today.
The big Red Caboose.
And that voice you hear is the voice of Stuart Acuff, getting ready to start up here with the Resistance Radio in just, less than a minute, actually. but just a good time for a station ID. You're listening to Enlightened Radio, and you can get to us at any time going to enlightenedradio.org, and you'll come up with a web page there, and there's a player on the page. If you're on a web regular computer, it just comes right up, and you'll see the player right on top. If you're on your phone, you have to drill down teensy bit to see it.
But you can hear the best radio being broadcast right in West Virginia.
By the way,
at enlightenedradio.org.
When we are not having a talk on here, I've converted most of the program. Haven't updated the calendar completely yet, but it's, we're going to be pretty evenly divided going through the week between jazz, bluegrass, and blues. And that's going to be
a good mix, man.
And it's going to be all live, and mostly from the great Internet Archive, or also what's the other one? We got Concert Vault. Yes,
the great genres of American music, upon which all other American
there are
music
other genres
is built.
That people, you know, like country and different kinds of rock, but if they want to do that, they're going to have to take over part of the programming so do that, and I'm happy to yield. I just want you to know in advance that if you got a thing you want to do Tabbouleh music, man, all day and all night, I mean, you want to wire in here and manage the automation on that, that's no problemo, okay?
But as long as John Case,
but I'm gonna do
the Red Caboose is doing the music, well, it's going to be real roots American music.
Right. So we got blues, bluegrass, and jazz, okay? And the jazz is actually the easiest to do because there's just tons of quality free jazz of various modes and descriptions, from experimental to smooth to, you know.
Do you know why, John?
No.
Because musicians love to play jazz. Because the better they are, the more challenging it is, and the more beautiful to their ears.
Mm.
Jazz.
Okay, I mean, they get a lot of, you know, interesting kind of sounds. But, you know, the blues tradition and the bluegrass tradition, especially here in
West Virginia,
I think, are both pretty strong, and
no doubt,
up and down, up and down the river here. And so we're gonna be drilling down on that one too, and we also have an immense number of resources, I think, available to us.
John, can we announce the beginning of the show?
Yes, it's now time to do it. Thank you very much. And let me turn the show over, a host to of the Resistance Radio, Stuart Acuff.
Good morning, good morning, good morning, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, friends and neighbors here in the Eastern Panhandle, across America and around the globe. It's great to have you on Resistance Radio here on www.enlightenradio.org. And a special good morning to my friends in the Eastern Panhandle Resistance, who I know are listening, and some of my friends in Martinsburg, who I know are listening, and compañeros from across America and around the world. It's so good to have you here on the Red Caboose in Bolivar, West Virginia, which really is an extension of Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. No, John's gonna challenge me on that.
Bolivar has Bolivar has its own history that hold on a second.
friends and neighbors, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, this is an argument that goes back 150 years.
That's right. See, Bolivar was the pro-Union, meaning pro-Lincoln.
Right.
Part of Virginia.
Right.
And because it, you know, had permanent employees of the foundry.
Right.
And the armory, part of the armory down at the bottom of the hill, which was a major strategic item here in Harper's Ferry.
Well, which produced all the munitions for the federal government.
That's right. So a very big deal. And some would say, well, okay, you were basically a federal employee, and so therefore you were loyal to the Union. But okay, but for whatever reason, the community up here, known by some as the Mudfords, okay?
Right.
For their great mud ball throwing children.
Right.
Who could.
There are even streets up here named after the Mudfords.
That's right. And so, but they were driven out by Stonewall Jackson, a rebel general, when he took the hill.
Yep.
And, by the way, there's a monument up there to one deserter from the Reb side who was hanged. But anyway.
So anyway, it's good to have you here at the Red Caboose in Bolivar, West Virginia. John Case is with me this morning. He is the founder station manager and brain behind EnlightenRadio.org. It's awfully good to have him guest hosting today and helping with the engineering and doing what got to be done for us to come to you through your devices.
That's right.
Your computer, your phone, or however you're listening to us.
Enlightened Radio, enlightenedradio.org.
www.enlightenedradio.org with 24-hour programming. I'll tell you this. If you turn on Enlightened Radio, you're going to be pulled in to a compelling presentation, whether that is morning news radio, which John does every morning, 5 days a week, every weekday morning, or it's a detective novel that's being acted out by radio players or radio actors.
Philip Marlowe. That's right, man.
Or it's Americana roots music, jazz, blues, or bluegrass, real Americana music, which is, you know, it's the music we should be most proud of as Americans, because actually, John, and I'm not going to go on this riff too long, but the best music in the world is the roots music, the traditional music of America. And the best of the traditional music of America was made between Clarksdale, Mississippi and St. Louis, Missouri, within 50 miles on either side of the Mississippi River. That river right there and that delta, both sides of the river, produced blues, produced rock and roll, produced country.
It's like the heart of soul.
It is the heart of soul. Produced the best soul music at Stax Records in Memphis, Tennessee.
No, I hear you.
You know, my daughter hand painted a shirt for me about Stax, and it's unreal how many people know that label that hasn't been in business since 1973 or four. And yet people still are aware of that music and that label.
The legend continues.
The legend continues. And it's such great music. I mean, oh, come on. Otis Redding, Sam and Dave, some of Aretha Franklin, not all of it, some of Wilson Pickett, the Staple Singers. I mean, Pop Staple, Mavis Staple. Incredible music. I'm just running on and on. There's a lot of news in the resistance this morning. In just a minute, the United States made a terrible decision yesterday, both domestically and globally. when the Attorney General announced that the government was going to rescind DACA, the deferred action for the children of immigrants, and which would lead to the deportation of 800,000 productive Americans, not citizens, but yet Americans, who were brought here as children by their parents and thus don't have citizenship, but who were brought here not of their own free will. And now this is their home. And at, in just a couple of minutes, my good friend Ana Avendano is calling in. She is one of the leading proponents in the United States of a just immigration system. She is the child of immigrants herself. They came from Chile. And she's a wonderful person and a very, very smart woman. And an attorney, and she's going to be calling in to talk about DACA and DACA, or however you say it, and get and drill down to what it does, what it means, where it came from, and what we have to do to stop this incredible injustice, this human rights violation of the highest order. Sending people back to a place they don't even know and may not even speak the same language. Terrible thing. So she'll be calling in a minute. The Attorney General Jeff Sessions made that announcement yesterday. That's fresh news. And John, there were people in demonstrations all over America yesterday. I suspect I haven't had a chance to look at the news this morning. There's Ana Avendano.
Good morning, and welcome to Enlightened Radio. Who's calling, please?
Good morning. This is Ana Avendano.
Hey, Ana. This is Stuart. How are you?
Hey, Stuart. I'm well. How are you?
I'm great. I'm great. Thank you so much for calling in. It is an important day for our listeners to hear your message, and friends and neighbors, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, I was talking a little bit about Ana a few minutes ago, but she is one of the leading proponents in America of just immigration policy. She's been on the front lines of the fight to protect immigrants and to treat immigrant people as human beings and not as commodity. I'm very fortunate to have known Ana for, I don't know, 10, 15 years now, and to have had the opportunity to work directly with Ana on some history-making projects at the AFL-CIO. So, Ana, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Oh, you're welcome, Stuart. Happy to do it.
So, Ana, you were part of the leadership of the fight to bring about DACA. In a minute, I'm going to want you to take us through that, the fight to bring about DACA. You know how you got the president to issue it, what it meant in the lives of the children of immigrant workers. And what its repeal or recension would do to America and to our country and to our people. So if you don't mind, start us with why you and your friends and neighbors put this fight together, what you were trying to achieve, and what that campaign looked like.
Sure. So, As you know, Stuart, and as I'm sure your listeners know, we have been fighting, we meaning the labor movement, together with our friends in the immigrant rights community and many others, have been fighting to change the immigration laws for, I'd say, two decades now. And we still haven't been able to accomplish that. So one piece of the fight for comprehensive immigration reform was what's come to be known as the DREAM Act, which is a law that was drafted by Senator Durbin way back, more than 15 years ago, that would give legal status to dreamers. In other words, young people who came to the United States as children and are now in college or in the military. And it was an attempt to just sort of work on one segment of the population that much needed relief. And the plan was that once dreamers were legalized, then America would be ready for a much broader legalization. Well, the DREAM Act was brought to the Senate in 2010 in December, and after it had passed the House, and it failed in the Senate by 5 votes.
Yeah.
And importantly, 5 Democrats voted against the DREAM Act. I think it's important to remember that screwing immigrants is a bipartisan issue. So after the DREAM Act failed, the Dreamers themselves, these young people, started to organize around the country on their own with no resources, just really hard work of organizing. And they came up with this idea that if Congress had failed them, the courts had failed them, the courts couldn't help them in any way, that the third branch of government, the executive, could help them.
And can I interrupt you for a second?
Of course.
They had a great argument because the federal government was deporting more people than it had under Bush. Am I right?
Absolutely. I mean, that, unfortunately, one of the biggest tragedies here is that everything we're seeing today, the table was set by President Obama and his advisors, who implemented a strategy that said, hey, if we are able to show the American people that we're serious about enforcing the immigration law, in other words, supporting as many people as we can, then they'll let us pass immigration reform. But that strategy was a huge failure.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Back to how.
No. I was just going to say. So after the failure of the DREAM Act in 2010 and 2011, the Dreamers started to organize around the country, really innovative, creative organizing tactics that included theater. They would show up, for example, at detention centers, asking to be arrested, and nobody knew what to do about that.
Right.
They would stage mock graduations. They organized, and then in 2012, which, as you know, was an election year.
And they organized in the labor movement. I mean,
a ton
of union campaigns became human rights campaigns and became pro-immigration reform campaigns, right? Particularly in the hotel industry.
Yeah, they just energized everybody because they were creative. They wouldn't take no for an answer. They looked at Washington and said, "You establishment, I'm not listening to you." Because, by the way, the entire D.C. establishment, and I don't mean the labor movement, because we were very supportive of the Dreamers, told them, don't do this, you can't do it, you can't get it done.
Right.
But, you know, what they did in 2012, they started taking over Obama campaign offices. They would just show up and do sit-down strikes.
Wow.
And it was the most intense, creative, wonderful, energetic organizing that I've ever seen to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And then President Obama during this time was saying he didn't have the authority to do anything until June 2012, when all of a sudden the Janet Napolitano, who was the head of the Department of Homeland Security, issues a memo saying, we're not going to deport Dreamers, which is what is now known as DACA, which is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. So
let me stop you, because I really want our listeners to get this. I didn't know this, so this is very fresh to me, and I suspect it's very fresh to a lot of our listeners. DACA came from the Department of Homeland Security as a result of a campaign of young immigrants themselves.
Absolutely. That's exactly what DACA, it was a huge organizing victory. And I think you have to, we have to remember that today.
Right.
Because organizing victories are not just taken away by policy, right? Organizing victories are maintained and preserved through organizing.
And power. And
power.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we're kind of dreaming, living in La La Land, if we're talking about changing America without talking about building and wielding power, right, Anna?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And these dreamers, young undocumented people, showed us what challenging power is.
You're right.
I mean, in the labor movement, too often we think that power is only corporate power.
Mm-hmm.
These kids took on the power of the state.
Right.
And won.
Right.
So in June, this memo comes out. It's a policy memo, which is now known as DACA. You know, President Trump yesterday said that he's taking that away. We're giving 6 months to Congress to do something about it. And if not, he'll revisit the issue. And by the way, Stuart, nobody knows what the heck that means.
Right. I was just going to ask you. Well, the first question is, do you think the Congress will pass legislation, or is it possible to get this Congress to pass legislation to stop the rescission of DACA, in other words, to legislatively enact DACA, or is this going to be a huge campaign issue in 2018?
Well, I think we have to be really careful. There's a huge difference between the DREAM Act, which would have given green cards to these young people.
Yeah.
And, you know, with green cards comes the possibility of citizenship, which brings all kinds of rights and the opportunity to have a voice in democracy. That's the DREAM Act.
Mm-hmm.
DACA is temporary status with no rights.
Gotcha.
People who have DACA have no access to the Affordable Care Act, have no access to any public benefits, really a very diminished set of rights.
Right.
So what we're going to see, I think, is Republicans trying to codify DACA, in other mm-hmm. words, to make this what it looks like going forward, and attach to that funding for the wall, a much
right.
more, you know, increased deportations, more detention centers, that sort of thing.
Right.
And I'm really afraid that the Democrats are going to cave.
Wow. This is a very important point, because now we're discussing in the resistance movement around the country, we're discussing what is the ask of our members of Congress, of our House members and our Senate members, as we engage to try to protect the children of immigrants. What is the ask? What is the demand? And so what
right.
you're saying is very important. And what you're saying is the demand has to be the passage of the DREAM Act, right?
Absolutely.
Say that again, then, so people...
Yeah. So the DREAM Act brings with it a full set of rights. It brings a green card. It brings the path to citizenship.
Right.
It means that every dreamer would then be, you know, functionally equivalent to anyone who was born here in terms of labor rights, social rights, economic rights.
Right. Everything but political rights.
Everything. And eventually, with citizenship, come political rights.
Yeah.
But that's what the DREAM Act offers, and that's why we have to fight for that. What we're now talking about is permanent temporariness. And
right.
I think that your listeners really need to see the implications of that. Think about that.
Right.
If in the future we are going to be okay with having a class of people who are
subclass
who we work with, right,
a subordinate class
with
right.
no access to not just a voice in democracy, because they'll never vote, but
a
no
modern day caste
system.
Well,
yeah. And so what does that mean in terms of, you know, worker rights? What does it mean in terms of social rights?
What does it mean
really
in terms
troubling.
Of democracy? I mean,
yeah, exactly.
You know, you can read American history One way you can read American history, I'm not saying it's the only way to read American history, but one way you can read American history is as a continuous struggle to give political rights to larger and to grant political rights to larger and larger segments of the American population. From ending chattel slavery to Reconstruction, and the empowerment of former slaves all over, certainly all over the South, to the fight for women's rights, to then the fight for labor rights, you know, to the fight for LGBT rights. And so if we're talking about taking political rights away from a class of Americans, we're swimming against the progressive tide of the history of America. Do you see it that way?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, Stuart. And also think about this, that the way that the temporary status is structured also is chips away at the New Deal, right? Because you have this entire population of people who have no access to the benefits of the New Deal.
Right.
Which is what, you know, neoliberalism is all about.
Yep.
So I think we have to be really careful.
Well, speaking of neoliberalism, that's a really good segue to the second part of this conversation I wanted you to expound on. You sent out an article the other day, a really fascinating article about the history of neoliberalism, who started it and why it started. And as I recall reading the article, I was really engrossed. I sent it to John Case, and he's the economist on enlightenradio.org. He is indeed, and he'll remind me of that several times before the end of the show, or the end of the day at least, my very good friend and leader, John Case. You know, the article said that the primary reason for neoliberalism was to break the unions and union power and worker power in the United States. Can you talk a little bit more about that article and what your understanding of the growth of neoliberalism and why and what it means?
Sure. So I found it fascinating. I keep reading. You know, I've made it a point to just try to be as informed as I can be about the root causes of what's happening today, right? Because I think we're getting so caught up in these personal sort of Bernie versus Hillary fights that we're losing sight of the larger picture.
Yeah, right. That is right? It's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've, you know, talking to a lot of Hillary supporters, I find it really interesting that many people don't even know about the Clinton Third Way or where this whole notion of U.S. neoliberalism came from.
Right.
And so when I've been, you know, digging up these articles, I think it's just important to remember that neoliberalism is something that didn't, the U.S. version of it, it didn't come from the Republicans. It came from a group of individuals, sort of journalists and thinkers and political analysts, who wanted to separate themselves or separate the Democratic Party from the traditional liberalism of the New Deal and the Great Society, who didn't believe in redistribution, but they wanted to have the sort of government for the good, and really started moving much more toward what ended up being the Bill Clinton presidency, much more tied to the financial sector, and really disdained unions, because unions were really represented a small, very small special interest. They interfered with the economy. They wanted too much and didn't share enough. And that was, you know, the genesis in the 70s.
Can I give you an example? Can I give our listeners of an example I actually personally witnessed? Was when Bill Clinton got the endorsement of the AFL-CIO for the presidency, somebody asked him openly on the floor of the general board of the AFL-CIO, which at the time was bigger than the executive council, but it was the body that was between the executive council and the convention. And I was there because all state and local central labor councils are included in the general board. But anyway, the question came, what's your, will you support a striker replacement and the right to organize? You may remember the striker replacement was hot in those days. And his response was, yes, but I have to get a promise from you that you'll reform all your antiquated and outdated work rules. And you know, your contracts.
Like to hell with safety.
Right.
Go ahead and walk that plank there, okay?
Right. So I was there and witnessed that part of the beginning of neoliberalism. But anyway, go ahead, Anna.
No. I think that, I mean, that's one of the things, Stuart. When one lives through this stuff, like we've been living through
right.
I think that we don't notice it as much as someone who's sort of looking back and studying it, right? Because we've seen this coming. We've seen the shift away from government support of the right to organize.
Right.
I mean, how many times has our efforts to change the labor law failed?
Yep.
And all during Democratic administrations.
Yep. Including,
well, we didn't make any progress under Reagan either.
No, but but including the biggest grassroots campaign, legislative campaign the AFL-CIO's ever run in the history of the American labor movement, the campaign for the Employee Free Choice Act.
Yep.
We built all our political decisions around that piece of legislation in 06 and 08, passed in the House in 09, and as you remember, no, 07 it passed in the House, and as you remember, we weren't able to get a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate in 09 or 010.
Yep.
But yeah, our efforts to change labor laws have failed.
And just going back to immigration for one quick second.
Please.
It's the neoliberalism has also driven immigration policy in this country since Reagan. Uh-huh. And if you look at every single attempt to change immigration law, has been really managed as a way to give employers a more vulnerable class of workers to this day.
Which is why the employers are not happy with DACA, right? The Chamber of Commerce is against the rescission of DACA.
And in my view, it's also why we gave Donald Trump a talking point, because it's really hard to look at the immigration law and say, no, you know, this law is a fair and just law to workers. It's not.
So you can't help but open the box, right?
I think, though, I mean, to unroll this a little bit, you know, to get to a position where a substantially different standard of workers' rights could be enforced would require a fairly different kind of a very large coalition. You know,
no question, absolutely,
that would have to be in agreement about you know, raising and doing some structural things about the inequality situation. I think, you know, for example, the I mean, what people call neoliberalism. I don't know when that name came. I can't even remember now. It's hard not to see its origin in the Nixon and Reagan presidency, especially the Reagan presidency. Okay, which as a former employee of the General Electric Company. Reagan espoused the General Electric philosophy, which promoted a gigantic accumulation of wealth. necessary to reproduce the, you know, then U.S. capitalist system, basically, on a scale that would satisfy, you know, all these growth requirements and everything. And they basically turned around and organized a campaign to destroy the New Deal and everything that went with it. But I think the destruction of unions and destruction of the New Deal and the social contract and then the renewed resistance to further civil rights after Johnson, you know, all came, was like this part of this thing. We have to get the political power to go take all the wealth back again. And that's what they've been doing ever since 72 anyway. All the wealth has gone back to the billionaires.
Yep.
And so now the big question is, how do you turn that structurally around? It's a big change. It's not just a bargaining.
Well, let's also say that one of the consequences of this process of building the theory and the ideology of neoliberalism and the power that the neoliberals have built, one of the consequences of that for everybody in America is 40 years of flat wages. And the recession of 2007 and 2008, because people borrowed too much money to keep up their standard of living. And that is two of the huge consequences of neoliberalism. And
what's non-neoliberalism now?
Response, and I don't mean to speak for Anna, but my response is non-neoliberalism is Bernie Sanderism. I mean,
all right, okay.
Bernie's talking a pretty, he's talking about a pretty fundamental change in the economy, but a democratic change, yeah, and a market-based change. How do you respond to the question of what is non-neoliberalism, Anna? And feel free to expand on John and me.
Yeah, so I agree with you, Stuart. I think that non-neoliberalism is, you know, an economy that works for working people.
Mm-hmm.
Economic policies that focus on redistribution.
Right.
You know, shoring up the social safety, strengthening unions. It's the Bernie revolution and then some.
Right.
But I would also encourage your readers to Google an article that appeared in the Washington Post on September 5th of 1982. It's an article by Charles Peters, who was then the author of the Washington Monthly, and it's titled A Neoliberal Manifesto.
Oh, right.
And in that article, he lays out the tenets of neoliberalism.
Wow.
And, you know, it's really interesting because you'll see that what we've been talking about here is, you know, we want fewer unions, we want less regulation. What we now essentially call liberalism is just the blueprint for what became the Third Way and the Clinton presidency.
So
it did start during the Reagan era, but it didn't just originate with Republicans.
Right. Right.
And I'm not being an apologist for the Republicans. I just think it's really important for us to fully understand where these policies come from and that they have consequences.
Well, and our challenges. I mean, if we're trying to fundamentally change the American economic model or economic vision, we have to know who we're going to have to win over and who has to be involved in that campaign. That's one of the reasons that a thorough, honest discussion like this is so very important. Let me put this in the form of a question. I'm sorry, Anna. But the vision of DACA and the vision of the DREAM Act reflect the differences between neoliberalism and a more liberal or progressive vision.
Right. The Dream Act was intended to give everybody equal opportunity, have access to the protections of the New Deal, have access to the American Dream. DACA was a temporary measure, never intended to create a system of permanent temporariness.
Right.
And that's where I think we're going, unfortunately. It was Obama's
response to the pressure generated by the Dreamers.
Exactly. It was their victory.
So what do we do now, Anna? How do those of us who, to quote scripture, thirst after justice, respond to this injustice of yesterday? What should we be thinking about? What should we try to move our colleagues to in the resistance movement? What is the way that the immigrant community and the community that cares about immigrants would have us respond to the injustice yesterday?
I think Stuart is trying to deploy all of our advocacy tools. I think we have to be vocal. I think we have to be out in the street. I think we have to be protesting. I think we have to be getting arrested. You know, we have to do everything we can to really raise not just DACA itself, but the issue of what it means to live in a country that is home to you and that have someone else tell you that you're not wanted here, that you're only here temporarily. So right. I think we have to fight for everybody. And I should add that we shouldn't just be fighting for the Dreamers. Tens of thousands of families have been torn apart just in the last few months, and hundreds of thousands over the last 10 years by this terrible militaristic immigration deportation machinery that we have in place. We need to stand up against that. We need to be very vocal, and we haven't been.
Right.
So, you know, we've seen spurts like the Muslim ban. Yes, we were wonderful during the Muslim ban, but like I said, there are millions of mostly low-wage workers who are terrified of being deported, just like the Dreamers are terrified of being deported. And it's up to us, those of us who have the privilege of full citizenship, to use that privilege on behalf of our immigrant brothers and sisters.
Oh, that's such a very good point. Those of us with privilege, who look like me, should have to, if we're going to act in a just manner, if we're going to really follow our thirst after justice, we have to use that privilege in the pursuit of justice for those who've been treated unjustly. And I think, you know, John and I on this show talk a lot about values because I believe our politics come from our values. If your values include justice for all people, your values lead you to engage in this campaign, massive campaign, that Anna is talking about. Those of us who fought for workers' rights for years and years, fought for women's rights for years and years, fought for the rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people for years and years, now have an obligation to fight for immigrants who, for the most part, happen to be brown. Not all, certainly, but for the most part. I know my kids go to school with a lot of immigrants just outside Washington, D.C. In their elementary school, the number one demographic in their elementary school were Ethiopian immigrants. The number two were Salvadoran immigrants. And the Ethiopian immigrants were by and large legal or documented. But the Salvadoran immigrants were split between who was documented and who wasn't. And so this issue has a huge effect on our communities. In many cases on our churches, certainly on our schools and on our neighborhoods and communities. This is a big issue of justice.
Yeah. And I think, Stuart, we also need to be really careful about the language that we use to talk about these issues. I'm really troubled by this notion that, you know, it's a very popular narrative that the Dreamers didn't do anything wrong, that, you know, that they came here through no fault of their own.
Right.
Because that's really putting the blame on their parents. And when you think of that, why do you think their parents brought their kids here? Out of vindictiveness, you know, out of some sort of malice. It was to build a better life.
Yep.
And I hate how that is really sort of dividing the good immigrant from the bad immigrant.
Right.
But it's unfortunately a really common narrative right now. So that's, you know, just careful of the language that we use has to be a big part of what we do.
So for us, our listeners who are warriors for justice, and that's most of our listeners to this show, we have to approach this question about, is it DACA or DACA?
It's DACA.
DACA. Okay, we have to.
You just said
in Tennessee, it's DACA.
It sounded to me like you just said it the opposite of what she just said. I did.
In Tennessee, it's DACA. I'm telling you what I know.
Okay.
I'm telling you the God's honest truth. In West Tennessee, in the swamps and bottomlands of West Tennessee, it's DACA. We have to approach this question of the rescission of DACA from the point of view and from the vision of immigrants and immigrant advocates, rather than as white liberals or white progressives. Is that an accurate way of expressing that?
Yes. Thank you, Stuart. Yes.
And we have to be willing to use our privilege. This is a case. We talk a lot about we have to have this question of race in America. Nobody wants to have the question, the conversation about race in America. It's too painful. It's too hard. People feel like if they're honest, they're slapped down. If they're not honest, they're slapped down. Nobody wants to engage in that. But here is an opportunity for white folks to demonstrate that they are using their privilege, white privilege, in support of and in solidarity with brown folks in America. And, you know, this is a just like the protection of African American, particularly young men, but not just young men, African American people from the police forces of this country. This question of protecting brown folks, Latino folks, from the assault of the state is a huge issue of basic human rights and social justice.
And basic human dignity, absolutely.
Right. And if we allow this to be done in our name, we will be in violation of a number of more articles in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which we're already in the violation of way too much.
I mean, the measure of this guy's cruelty, you know, it's really, I think the President Obama's statement yesterday pegged it right on, actually, is that it's just, I mean, how does one defend that level of cruelty? You know, and I'm going to postpone it 6 months so that there can be some construction work done in Houston.
Right.
Because there's nobody else to do it but undocumented people, you know. I mean, it's just, I mean, the crudeness of it is just so.
the inhumaneness of it.
I mean, what a horrible example, an insulting example, I mean, to set. It's just, it's hard to.
And we have
so
to.
Why? This is the thing that I keep asking, and I would love to hear, right? But you think, why do his supporters continue to so staunchly support him?
Well, I mean, let's tell the essential truth here is that the Republican Party is not, does not just have racists in it. It is a party that has built itself. The modern Republican Party is built on racism and white supremacy. That's exactly, I mean, I watched it. I was in Texas when Ann Richards was the treasurer of the state, when Jim Hightower was in the
agriculture.
State. Yeah, yes, he was Secretary of Agriculture. And when the governor's cabinet were all progressives, Jim Maddox was the attorney general. And I watched Republicanism build in Texas, which I thought, because of the Latino population, would always be a progressive state. I was totally wrong. I was in Georgia when Georgia lost its Democratic majority. And the same thing. I mean, the best governor Georgia ever had, Roy Barnes, lost a second term because he changed the state flag. He made the stars and bars. He took it out of the flag. And he got defeated in the next election. And Georgia now has been, is represented in almost entirely by right-wing Republicans. You know, the kind of attitude that goes into rescinding DACA is part and parcel what it means to be a Republican these days. I think it's ideological. I think it's hate and anger based.
But this all, it goes all the way back to Nixon's strategy, basically.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
The Southern strategy, and that was going to be the argument, right? Would the civil rights movement empower enough African American voters to retain the Democratic Party strength, or would, you know, the Republican you know, move to take over the all of the segregationist vote,
right?
Win, and it looked like the Republicans won, you know, in that little
right
contest.
And, oddly,
and they used it, and they used it as the leverage to take the presidency with Reagan, and then,
right.
And it was after Reagan, right? You know, really, it was after Reagan, and then Bush. Okay, that when Clinton came and said, "Oh, well, you know, going back to LBJ, which is the last of the New Dealers, really,
the Great Society,
you know, isn't going to win it."
Right.
That was Clinton's argument. You know, he wasn't really bashful about it. You know, he said it straight out. Okay,
and he acted on it. That's why he challenged us at the AFL-CIO. That's why he had the Sister Soldier moment with Reverend Jackson at the Rainbow Push Convention.
Right. I mean, he made it, you know, a straightforward thing. And, you know, because why? Well, you know, because, you know, he was using, you know, where was the money coming from? You know, the liberal bankers, Robert Rubin. He's a liberal, but he's a Wall Street guy. And then you had the tech industry coming up, you know, that was getting behind Bill. And they actually think they did believe that the high-tech industry was going to cause some kind of explosion in wealth that would make you'd have another boom
It did cause an explosion.
Well, no, actually, it did not. Yeah, that's the problem. It did not. Okay, and so far, it has not. We had a blip out of it, but let me tell you, the automobile did 100 times more than the high-tech has done so far. In terms of and whatever it has done has gone to the 1%. Okay?
Right.
So, and we got and none of it.
Has created a few more people in the 1%.
But, you know, so the high tech, there was a little blip in income about 97, 98, 99, you know, where you had a little bit of blip in median income. But fundamentally, you know, even that since then, no.
Yep.
So it's only a small part of the work. Well, I don't, it's actually an interesting part of the workforce that's being, you know, trained, okay, to do all this software and tangible networking, you know, all the computer stuff. And, and they're all being trained to do it, but I don't know that it's weird that even with that, service industry wages are dragging the whole thing down.
Yep, absolutely.
So no one's getting, the median's not going anywhere.
Right. Ladies and gentlemen, friends and neighbors, brothers and sisters, you're listening to Resistance Radio here on enlightenedradio.org. We have been listening to and having a wonderful conversation, an enlightening conversation, an educational conversation, an edification conversation with my friend, co-conspirator. Someday, she and I will tell you the story on the radio about the first time the AFL-CIO admitted as a member was a non-union workers organization, because Anna and I were both at the table. She did more work on it than I did, but it's a great story. We'll tell it another time. But brothers and sisters, we all thank you, Anna, for being with us, and how important your message is. We'll send you a podcast, and we'll post a podcast, and I urge our listeners to download the podcast and send it to like-minded warriors for justice. We really need to hit this DACA thing hard, and we need to advocate for the DREAM Act, for a just immigration system. And when we do that, we will be following the lead of our friend and colleague Anna Avendano and many other women and men of Latino descent who are helping us do what is right and what is just in this dark moment. Thank you, Anna, so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Stuart. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Well, wow, that was fun. What a smart woman.
Oh, yeah.
And to think I was able to work with her for years at the AFL-CIO. She's really an inspiration. I think her parents were lefties in Chile. I think that's why they immigrated to the United States during the Pinochet years. To escape persecution.
Yeah. Okay.
When the military destroyed a democratic revolution in Chile.
Right.
She's awfully good people. It was wonderful to deal with her in the context of organizing on immigrant issues. Because more and more of our most biggest organizing unions were organizing primarily brown people and Latino immigrants.
If you got a multinational workforce and it in global, and we assume that globalization is not going to start backing up, I mean, unless we have a world war, what should be... What does citizenship start to mean?
Well, that's a good question.
For example, I mean, let's assume that no matter what law is passed, if it changes the status of a lot of folks in the country to illegal, I mean, are they going to move 800,000 at once? No, they're going to move 10,000, and the rest are going to live in terror.
Right. That's exactly right.
That's what the employer. Some of the employers dig. For years, there's been people in California hiring illegal folks, undocumented folks, deliberately so that they can screw them out of every last little dime.
Well, that's how our food comes to us.
Yeah,
primarily. So, I'm gonna have to go in a second.
I'm sorry,
but no. But let me, because I'm gonna turn the microphone back over to you. But let me remind our listeners: we'll be here at 10 o'clock next Wednesday. Resistance Radio, and next Wednesday, our guest will be a young woman organizer of the West Virginia Resistance Movement, and I think you'll really enjoy that conversation. So please be with us next Wednesday at 10 a.m. John, you might want to play some music to send us off.
Well, we could.
Or you could finish your thought.
Well, I mean, the only thought that I really had was is that those who do the work of the world ought to be united, and so I don't know however we get it done. Amen. That the citizenship make we can't let that take us apart too much somehow, because we're going to be working together, bound to be. All right, here's a little bit of, we need a little bit of, I'd say rebellious song here. We have some of that in the form of, the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makin, and we'll do. Here's an outlaw song. They always like this thing. We'll do a little bit of that.
We're going to leave you. We're going to leave you with the song that comes from our own county in Tipperary. It's a song about another outlaw, a fella who plied his trade on the Kilworth Mountains between Cork and Tipperary. His name's Willie Brennan. They called him Brennan on the Moor.
And many a wealthy nobleman before it shook with fear. And it's Brennan on the moor, bold, brave and undaunted was young Brennan on the moor. One day upon the highway, as Willie he went down, he met the mayor of Cashel, a mile outside the town. The mayor he knew his features, and he said, "Young man," said he, "your name is Willie Brennan, you must come along with me." And it's wife had gone to town, provisions for the way. And when she saw her only, she commenced to weep and cry. Did hand to me that tenpenny, as soon as Willie spoke, she handed him a blunderbuss from underneath her cloak. Brennan on the moor, bold, brave and undaunted was young Brennan on the moor.
Now with this loaded blunderbuss that rode by will unfold, robbed him of his gold. £100 was offered for his apprehension there. So gear and horse and saddle tow the mountain did repair.
Did young Brennan on the moor, bold, brave and undaunted was young Brennan on the moor. Now Brennan made an apart on the mountain's high, with cavalry and infantry to take him they did try. He laughed at them with scorn until at last was said, "A false hearted woman he was cruelly betrayed."